by inch, row by row, gonna make this garden grow. All it takes is a rake and a hoe and a piece of fertile ground. An inch by inch.
Welcome to the Manic Gardener. Sustainable and organic gardening information, as well as in-depth looks at related issues. This week's topic, large-scale composting at a minimal cost and with even less effort. We'll be talking with Michael Dalton and MJ Arends, who have put this process in place in their hometown of Great Falls, Montana, and across the state. We'll also talk with Gail Gifford, the executive director of the Great Falls Food Bank, which was one of their first clients, and which has managed to reduce the amount of garbage it produces from 1,000 pounds to 40,000 pounds last year, and that's before the process was even entirely up and running. We'll have a gardening tip at the end of the show, of course. And you can check my blog, themanicgardener.com, for information about guests, background, and all the links. Backyard gardeners often take up composting for the product. They want the compost, and the compost is expensive. Another good reason, and a lot of people are already aware of this, is to keep waste out of landfills and incinerators, neither of which is remotely good for the environment. Facing increasing pressure on their landfills, a lot of municipalities, counties, and so on across North America have been turning to composting. But in almost all cases, this is the large-scale version of the backyard hot pile. That means it's aerobic, it requires oxygen, and that means it needs to be turned because the microbes inside the pile keep running out of oxygen. You've got to give them more. To turn a pile this big, you need machinery. So the process is not only expensive, it's also not as green as one would like. The machines themselves are a big investment in terms of money and production costs, and they run on fossil fuels. Until recently, however, this was just seen as the only way to do it. Now, Bokashi is emerging as an alternative. On last week's show, Kitchen Composting, Bokashi 101, I interviewed Jenny Harlan in Sweden, who talked about how to do Bokashi composting in your kitchen. You don't even need a backyard for this. This week, we're going to look at the same process, but on a much larger scale. I'm not sure where I first heard about Bokashi. It may have been while I was doing research for an enormous article on composting, which you can find at composterconnection.com. Wherever I learned about it, I knew about it as an in-home composting method, but I had no idea that it could be done on a large scale until last March, when I went to a Bioneers conference here in Bozeman, Montana, where I live. And by the way, if you don't know about the Bioneers, they do amazing stuff, and you should definitely look them up. I'll try to get them on for some shows later. At any rate, at this conference, a couple from Great Falls spoke about the large-scale Bokashi project that they were setting up in their hometown. I posted about this at the time on my blog, themanicgardener.com. I was really blown away by what they had on their site, gardensfromgarbage.org, and the work they were doing. And so when I decided to do something on composting for the podcast, they were an obvious target. And I want to start off by just saying we are here today with Michael Dalton and MJ Arends. Am I saying that correctly?
Good enough.
Okay. Okay, now I first heard about you folks when you came to speak at a Bioneers conference here in Bozeman last spring. And I learned that you were doing large-scale Bokashi composting. Now,
yes.
Unlike probably, what, I don't know, 95% of people in the country, I had at least heard of bokashi. But I'd never heard of large-scale bokashi. But why don't we start small? And I would like to ask you briefly to explain what bokashi is. Who wants to do that?
Well, speaking internationally, Kate, first of all, bokashi is a Japanese term.
Yes.
And this method of composting has been done in Sweden and New Zealand and many other parts of the world, been doing, and even in Africa, they've been doing bokashi composting for for decades. And so it's very, very new to North America. And you said 95%. I would say it's closer to 99.5% who have never even heard the term, which is Japanese for organic fermented matter. The matter in this case is wheat bran. In Sweden, I'm not sure what the matter is. I know in other parts of our country they use rice bran. You can use sawdust to ferment with these microbes.
Fermenting does not have a great reputation, shall we say. It doesn't sound nice.
Well, then let's use the other term that we use all the time, and that is to inoculate, in our case, wheat bran with these microbes.
How do you do that?
It's a very, very simple process. We get the concentrate from a plant in Tucson.
And the concentrate has the microbes?
The concentrate is that's what it is. It's microbes that are suspended in water with some molasses, which sustains the life of the microbes themselves.
Gives them something to feed on.
That's correct.
Right.
And then we add a very small portion of the concentrate, that is the liquid microbes, into a big bucket. In fact, we're now engaged in 25-gallon bowls, if you will, that they use in places like bakeries. And we put several gallons of pure water in there, along with a small amount of the microbes and an equally small amount of molasses. And then we add large quantities of wheat bran, which is a byproduct of our local flour mills. Mix it all up. We then put it in airtight buckets and seal the bucket up. And in 14 to 21 days, everything, all of those flakes of wheat bran are fermented. We then remove them from the buckets and we spread them out on recycled window screens in a greenhouse, and they air dry in about 24 hours.
Mm-hmm.
We then put them into bags or big bags for bulk use. And as such, so long as we keep the bags sealed tight and prevent them from getting too hot from even solar heat, they have an indefinite shelf life.
I see. Okay. So that's the preparation of the inoculant.
Yes.
Okay. And you use this inoculant with mostly kitchen scraps and put that in sealed containers, correct?
Yes. And that sealed container can be in anything as small as a 3 or a 5 gallon bucket with a lid on it. To the very large forms that we have developed and install wherever it's requested. And those boxes that have modules inside, well, our biggest one at this point is the one that we have at our food bank, and it's 30 feet long, has 7 modules within it. They're all insulated, they're airtight, and they're capable of producing or composting 45 tons of food waste a year.
Heavens. Okay. Well,
yeah.
We'll return to the technical details in a few minutes, but I wanted to ask you first, you mentioned schools, you mentioned a food bank. What are you doing with these organizations?
Well, actually, we started with one school a year ago, Valley View Elementary, who said, we want to learn to compost. We want to do this in our school.
They came to you.
They came. We had been actively saying to everybody that we worked with, we need to try to get this into the schools because the answer to our future is through the kids.
Uh-huh.
And so a school principal approached us and said, I want a bin. I want to start this. And that was our first installation of a school bin. We had a blueprint drawn up and donated to us by an architect, a local architect, who happens to now be president of our board of directors.
I see.
And we built an airtight school bin, and Michael, a.k.a. Captain Compost,
I see.
went into the school, worked with the sixth grade leadership students, and those students then went to all the other classrooms and explained to kids what the school was doing and how to separate the yummies from the yuckies in the lunchroom.
That's the technical term?
That's the technical term.
Okay.
And the school started composting. And now, then throughout the year, we added six more schools. This fall.
In that first year?
In that first year.
Wow.
So now we're adding three more schools this fall so that we'll have one middle school and nine or ten, Michael?
Ten
elementaries. So that's where we are with 10 elementary schools and one middle school.
The food bank in Helena and MSU, probably around the 1st of November, will build their first modules, and they'll start composting on campus.
Mm-hmm.
And when they're done with their trial period, they will begin composting 300 tons of food waste that historically they've been hauling 30 miles out of town to the landfill, and they won't be doing that anymore. They're going to keep their garbage at home, and they call that 300 cubic yards of good soil every year.
Okay. So you are really moving across a lot of space here.
Well, and it's all, Kate, it's all about that thing that we refer to very affectionately as the tipping point. It's that across this country and probably beyond, people are waking up and saying, you know, we need to be doing more locally to sustain ourselves with what we produce, what we raise, what we feed our kids. And therefore, we don't have to say anything to all of these communities. They say, we need to be gardening, and we know that at the same time, we need to be recycling and starve our landfills and keep all that food waste at home and make really good chemical-free soil available to do all of our gardening
Starve our landfills. Why?
Yeah. Yeah.
What's the problem with putting kitchen garbage in the landfill?
Well, any community and any landfill, if you were to investigate it in detail, you would find that as much as 40% of by volume of what's in that landfill is compostable. It is food waste. It is yard waste. And then you've got all the issues of off-gassing of the greenhouse gases that happens in traditional landfills.
Explain that, you would.
It's just in the rotting process that goes on in a landfill, there's the methane gases and all the others that are given off into the atmosphere. This method of composting that we do, there is no off-gassing.
And methane gas is, 20 times worse as a greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide? Is that right? Something on that order.
That sounds accurate to me.
Yeah.
Then there's the other thing, the carbon footprint of how many gallons of diesel fuel are needed to transport all of our food waste to the landfill. In the case of Red Lodge, they transport all of their food waste over 60 miles one way just to the nearest landfill, which is in Billings. MSU and Bozeman in general trucks theirs over 30 miles out of town to Logan. So you start putting the pencil to that expense of just labor and the diesel fuel, and you think, well, we can't afford to do that anymore.
It would be interesting to do the math.
Yeah.
Figure out what that costs just in terms of dollars, much less in terms of exhaust.
Well, we've done the math with our local schools.
Have you?
And locally, our schools' cafeterias are composting what nationally seems to be a very similar figure. And so our enrollments of 500 students in a school, they daily are composting 30 to 35 pounds of food waste. That computes into about 3 tons of food waste per school per year. And so we say to the schools, keep the kids' garbage on campus, and you, each of you, will save about $2,000 in what are called transfer fees of hauling all their food waste to the landfill.
Wow, that's significant. Yeah. Let me ask a question about how it works, but not at the technical end yet.
Sure.
Okay, the people in the school, they separate, what was it, the yummies from the yuckies?
Correct.
The yummies being, I assume, the things that the little microbes want to eat. And what are you separating? What goes in and what doesn't go in?
Well, essentially, everything that's food goes in, with the very distinct exceptions being meat, fish, and the rinds of citrus, the rinds being way too acidic, and the microbes and at that low acidic level just don't function at all.
Hmm.
Kate,
yes.
I know you don't want to get technical yet, but when we do Bokashi bucket composting and ferment our food waste, we can compost everything that comes out of the kitchen.
Right.
So there is a difference here, and people need to be aware that if they're willing to do the bucket composting, then we can do the meat, the dairy, the fish, the oils, everything. So,
and that's much more than you put in your traditional backyard compost heap, where
yep.
you're not supposed to include your dairy or any
right.
meat or fish products.
Right. And
right.
so we call it bucket composting and table
right.
or table to bin. And there's
okay.
we do both. So there is a distinction there.
Great. Well, let's come back to that in a minute or two. First, back to the schools. Here are these schools. They've got this, you know, somebody has scraped together everything that needs to go into the Bokashi bin. They take it out to the Bokashi bin. They dump it in. What happens next?
Then they have a measuring cup, a half cup measuring cup. They go into the bucket of Bokashi, this inoculated wheat bran. They scoop out half a cup. They scatter it over the surface of that day's deposit of 35 pounds. And it's only that half a cup they put in, along with 1 pound of carbon, and carbon meaning that other element that's necessary to be mixed in with the nitrogen, which is all the food waste, in order to complete the composting process. That 1 pound.
What provides the carbon?
Well, in our case, we're the city's composting site is donating all of the wood chips from all of the elm trees that they've been removing and chipping over the last
because
several
they're,
years.
because they're the elm trees are diseased.
Yep. So
okay.
we take that those wood chips, which 1 pound is the equivalent of about a gallon container, and they just sprinkle that over the top, and then they close up the bin. That's it. They do not turn in the system. There's no labor involved. You just dump in the components and seal it back up.
I see. Now, so they're putting in about 35 pounds of kitchen waste,
yes.
a pound of wood chips,
yes.
and half a cup of the Bokashi inoculant.
That's correct.
What is that half cup worth?
You mean in dollars and cents?
Yeah, yeah.
Well,
how much does it cost?
I can't speak in terms of that small amounts. I just know that each of these schools is using about 5 pounds of Bokashi to compost each ton. And a pound costs, they buy it from us at $4 a pound, so it costs them about $20 per ton to compost, or it costs them about $60 a year.
Uh-huh. Well, you do bucket composting at home, don't
yes,
you?
Yes, we do. We do both table to bin and bucket composting.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And
Michael and I've had a learning curve for the 3 years that we've been since we first learned about Bokashi. We've had a learning curve. We've made every mistake in the book, and we share that with people because they're often embarrassed to call us and say, I've got white mold, or I have this, or I have that, and we say, look, there's no news to us. We've made all the mistakes, and we continue to make them because this is new to all of us.
And how long, once you close one of these large bins,
yes.
how long do you leave it shut?
60 to 90 days.
60 to 90 days. Yes. And since it's got the brown matter in with it, unlike the home compost bokashi buckets, it has everything that it needs to produce what MJ is calling good dirt.
Good dirt.
Is that right?
Yes, good dirt, yep.
Okay, so when you finally open it up after 2 or 3 months, what do you see?
Dirt.
Dirt.
That's it.
Completely composted.
Oh, we put whole vegetables. We put beets and potatoes and whole cantaloupe and all kinds of things in there whole. And other than the fact we need to cut open things like squash and cantaloupe to make sure that those seeds are fermented as well, preventing germination.
Uh-huh.
You open up that bin, there's nothing, there's not a form of anything, of fruit or vegetable in there. It's just soil-tested good dirt.
Okay, and ready to use.
Ready to use, oh yeah.
Wow, okay. Well, what happens to the good dirt that is made at the schools and at the food bank? Where does that go?
Well, we give the kids options, and we say to them, and they ask us, they say, well, then what happens with your dirt? And I say, no, kids, it's yours. What do you want to do with it?
Ah.
Do you want to bag it up and go door-to-door in your neighborhood and sell it as a fundraiser?
Uh-huh.
Do you want to have flower boxes in your classrooms? Do you want to go out and stir it in with your flower beds in front of the school? Do you want a garden? And mm-hmm. one of our elementaries, our first elementary school to get started, well, there's the two that started almost simultaneously. One of them is the principal has approached us and said, the kids want a greenhouse. So they'll all of their soil will go into their greenhouse. The other school said, we want a garden. So some parents came in and established a raised bed, and we've started transferring their soil that they made into their, and they had their first harvest of sunflowers and tomatoes just a couple of weeks ago.
That's wonderful. That must be very exciting for them.
Well, they're very proud, and rightfully
yes.
so, because they own the whole process. And when they look at their own carrots and their own tomatoes and say, wow, I think I'll eat that. I made that. That there's the
Are they more likely to eat vegetables that they grew?
Oh, boy, are they ever.
Yeah,
and for many of those kids, it's the first time they've ever had a bite of a fresh carrot or a juicy tomato, and they're just exhilarated with the flavors that are there. They have no idea.
Yes,
thrilled.
It makes a difference.
Oh, huge.
Yeah, that's exciting. Okay, you've got your buckets, and MJ, you were distinguishing between two different kinds of buckets. I wasn't quite clear about
Okay, not two different kinds of buckets. There's
the bins, which are huge.
There's the bins. So there's what we call table to bin. A lot of people bucket compost. They want to take their food waste right out to the bin, and that's when we suggest that they do not put meat, dairy, or heavy oils into the bin. Number one, they're slower to compost, and they will attract pests. And you're just, as in traditional composting, it's just better not to go table to bin with those products.
I see.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Now, I want to turn the corner to the dark side of the whole process, MJ.
Okay.
You said something about mistakes.
Oh, yes.
Yes, tell us about your mistakes, if you would.
The dark side is called the learning curve. We're going to just
the learning curve.
That
okay.
Page. Yes, and there is definitely a learning curve because there is when the microbes are active, and you open your containers and you see white mold. For most of us, mold is oh no.
But panic.
This isn't working. What am I going to do? I've done something wrong. And white mold is a good thing with these microbes and how they work. If your mold is blue or black, then you go, oh, something happened. It doesn't mean you did anything wrong. It just probably air got in there. Maybe there wasn't enough bokashi. And you take your what has now pretty much putrefied. There's a difference. Things decompose in two ways. They putrefy or they ferment. And what we're doing is fermenting, but as Michael and I both know, we've had our share of putrefied food waste.
Now, and the difference is the different microbes that are at work?
No. Well, ours, Bokashi composting, ideally is an anaerobic method.
Meaning
that without oxygen. That's why we build airtight bins and have 5-gallon buckets with a very tight lid.
And that's why you don't need to turn it, because turning is to introduce oxygen.
Yes, and traditional composting is an aerobic method. You want the oxygen in there to help the heat process. Ours is a high acidic process. So we're fermenting, and fermenting, as people know who do canning or making pickles from cucumbers or any of that, is an anaerobic. You want to ferment in an oxygen-free atmosphere or environment.
Right.
And so you fermenting, if too much air gets in there, you end up putrefying or rotting instead. You can still trench that in your garden. You know, it's still good. It's still going to make compost. It's just that you're going to be very offended by the odor.
I see. So, it's not just a clean, strong vinegar odor.
It's rotting
yucky
food, and you can smell it all the way across the yard. We've had classes in our backyard where we were teaching winter composting or Bokashi cold composting, and opened a bucket that we thought was perfectly fermented.
Oh, no.
And the stench just threw us all into a mess. So we've done
drove all your students out of the yard.
Yes.
They didn't even come back and ask for refunds?
Oh no. Actually, you start laughing, and people realize that we, too, as teachers, have made all the mistakes. So it calms people to know that then they can call us and say, okay, this happened, and what do I do about it? You know, when we're all in this together, and we are, it's not that we know more because we've played with it for 3 years.
And there's the other part of that. We've been talking about putrefaction of the food waste, but there's also the putrefaction of the solution, the liquid that goes to the bottom of the bucket or goes to the bottom of one of our compost modules, which have and those are developed in two ways. Either there's no bottom in there and all the juice goes right into the soil underneath.
Okay, hang on one second, because I think we're getting to the technical side.
Well, and you're right. Okay. I just want to differentiate that you're always going to have some fluid in there. And if that fluid gets exposed to the air, it too will putrefy. And if it leaks out of a bin, it's going to get out on the ground and it will stink. The correction of that, very simply, is to add a third of a cup of white sugar, and that reactivates
to
the microbes.
What?
Just mix it into the food waste, mix it into the solution that's accumulating in the bottom, and the microbes are reactivated, and then within, it seems like less than an hour, all the smell is gone.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Okay, so the process produces a fair amount of liquid, and if you buy a home Bokashi bin, it often has a little spigot at the bottom. You can drain off the liquid, correct?
Yes.
Okay.
And that's the reason for the spigot, because the solution seems to sour faster than the food can ferment.
And what do you do with that, with the liquid that you draw off?
Well, ideally, and it might have even been in our conversation, Kate, that you gave me the term leachate. Is that true?
Possibly, yes.
I've been calling it compost tea, but it really isn't. That is a very good, what do I want to call it? Fertilizer, but it has to be mixed 1 to 100 with water. You really have to dilute that solution. It's very, very strong.
Because it's so acidic?
Because it's so acidic. And then you can use it, and you can pour it on your plants, and it feeds the soil. It's, again, microbe rich. So it helps. It really is a good soil additive, but it's strong. So just
Okay.
That's a matter of
awareness.
If
you can't stand the odor, you can mix in a little bit of sugar with it?
Oh, absolutely. And it just activates okay. the microbes.
All right. Now, here's the other side of the downside. I want to ask about possible problems or drawbacks here, because in traditional backyard composting, you've mentioned heat several times, Michael, and indeed it's the heat in a hot compost pile that will kill pathogens and seeds. And without that, you could be spreading any diseases that might be on leaves that you put in your compost pile. And you might also be spreading any dandelions that you had thrown in. How does the bokashi deal with those two issues, seeds and pathogens?
Those microbes convert everything to such a low pH level that...
go ahead.
Another perspective
I started to interrupt him. That's okay. What happens in this process, technically, is that it's the acidity. We try to keep weeds...
It's the acidity that does
it's
what?
It's the acidity that takes care of all the pathogens.
And the acidifying microbes grow in an anaerobic and oxygen-free environment?
Yes.
And that's why it smells like vinegar when you open it up.
Exactly.
Vinegar is acidic.
Yes.
Okay. And you're saying that it's the acidity that kills pathogens?
Yes. It's the high acidity that will take care of the pathogens. We're still pretty careful about weeds. And just because we are still learning. So when we pull weeds, we tend to put those in the garbage, or we do them separately because we're still in the experimental stage with our weed, a lot of the weeding.
Put them in the garbage. I'm shocked.
I know. That's why I say.
That goes to the landfill.
We're all in a learning curve here, and so I'm not going to say anything at all definitive about weeds. What Michael said about cutting open the cantaloupe, because we have fermented whole cantaloupe before, and when I planted my garden this spring, I scraped back all of my topsoil and put in what I call slurry, which is the fermented food waste. And I
from
noticed
a bokashi
whole,
bin.
I noticed
mm-hmm.
some whole fruit in there, but I didn't think anything of it. And so I chopped up the cantaloupes and the squash and spread them on my garden and put the dirt back on top, knowing mm-hmm. that's one of the methods that we say works beautifully.
Right.
Well,
and excuse me. This is the method of burying what you have composted at home in
a bucket.
Indoor 5-gallon bucket.
Exactly.
Right. Okay.
And so before I had planted anything, I went back to look at my plot, and I had things growing all over my garden that
you had not actively planted.
That I had not planted, and I said, "What is this?" And so then we started talking about it and realizing that the cantaloupe or the squash, whatever it was, I can't remember, that I had cut open that I thought was fully fermented was mm-hmm. not. And the seeds, of course, sprouted in my garden bed, and I was raising a whole crop of cantaloupe, which I had absolutely no intention of growing.
I see.
So at that point, we said, well, okay, lesson number 19 or whatever it was, that we...
Right.
You need to cut open anything that has seeds so that you get the fermenting process to deactivate all the seeds that you're dealing with.
Right.
So that was a
now,
good lesson for us. Yes.
Okay. And, Michael, I think you said that bokashi composting does not produce methane.
Well, greenhouse gases in general, yes.
Okay. See, that surprises me because one of the reasons why landfills do is because they are anaerobic.
Yes. Well, technically they are, but in this method, because this is a fermentation process and not a rotting method, it's an all-new activity of biochemistry.
So that's the difference between the two.
Oh, absolutely.
In a landfill, you have rotting,
yeah.
not fermenting.
That's correct.
And it's the rotting that produces the methane.
Yes.
Amazing.
Uh-huh.
Now, the other downside of bokashi, as I understand it, is that you can't include a lot of yard waste. You're talking almost exclusively about kitchen waste.
We focus on kitchen waste, but you absolutely can compost your yard waste, your leaves, your grass, whether it be fresh or dried, your leaves, whether they be green or dried. If they're green, then they're nitrogen. If they're brown, then they're carbon. And in both cases, they're a very integral part of composting system, of bokashi composting systems.
Mm-hmm. And do you have recipes up on your site that would tell people how to mix different amounts of green and brown, nitrogen and carbon heavy yard wastes to get a successful bokashi mix?
The recipe is really simple, and it's 30 to 1. 30 parts nitrogen to every 1 part of carbon.
Mm-hmm.
What's 30? 30 what and 1 what? Well, we think of the schools that are producing 30 pounds of nitrogen food waste a day, and we mm-hmm. add 1 pound of carbon, in this case wood chips, every day, and there's our recipe that works beautifully. If you put too much carbon in, if we were to put 3 or 4 pounds of wood chips in with every 30 pounds, it really slows down the system. Doesn't mm-hmm. negate it, it just slows it down. If you put less than 1 pound of wood chips in there, then you end up with the two-stage process stops or slows down, and you end up with a lot of heavily pickled food waste sitting in your bin.
Right. Okay. Have you had any detractors? Have any people stood up and said this is a bad idea, we shouldn't be doing this in our schools?
Well, the only detractors, and they have been right on task when they've stepped up and said, we're not liking this because it smells. And we've said, oh, right, it does smell because of an error in our installation of the system.
Uh-huh.
That is, we ended up with either temperature leaks in the boxes, or we ended up with liquid leaks in the bottom.
I see.
And the juice leaked out and putrefied, and their
That's
complaints
stinky.
Were valid, and we made the corrections in our installations and in our catchment systems, and the complaints went away because the concern went away, and
there's
nothing beyond that.
Okay. So when you say temperature leaks, you mean that the boxes weren't tight enough and therefore the temperature didn't stay high enough?
The temperature leak allowed that 20 below weather to seep in.
Right.
And
cool down.
Yeah.
And then things started to rot instead?
No, they didn't even rot. They just were suspended because they got too cold. Below about 40 degrees, the microbes really slow down. And like anything, like us humans, which are also, we're just trillions and trillions of microbes, the microbes in the bin also were suspended until springtime, until it thawed out.
I wouldn't have thought that would lead to a complaint about odor. Unless it warmed up, then it stank.
There you go. When it warmed up and then it started to putrefy. Yeah.
Got it. Yeah, which just, has an even worse reputation than fermenting. Yes.
Uh-huh.
And
yep.
For good reason.
For good reason.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So what's your next move?
I'm going to interrupt here.
All right.
Just for a second, Kate.
Sure.
Just because I want to mention a couple of the other uses for bokashi, and it's not just in composting.
All right.
If you have a septic system, you can use it to clear up your sludge in your septic system. Michael puts it in his smoothies in the morning. It's a wonderful probiotic for our human bellies.
Mm-hmm.
It's
and this is the inoculant you're talking about here.
This is
the brand.
Bokashi. Uh-huh.
Right. But
right.
not the fermented food.
No, but you know, the wonderful thing about fermented food is that it will support human life.
All right.
And that's a plus. Because
yes.
Just because there is no danger in bokashi, it's good for pets, dogs tend to eat it. We put it in cat litter to cut down on odors. Humans eat it.
But when you're saying bokashi, I just want to clarify here. You're talking about the fermented, the bran. You're not talking about the fermented food from the bin or from the bucket. Am I right?
When I say the word bokashi, yes, I'm talking about the bran because that's the name of the bran.
Right.
What I did say is that the fermented food will support human life.
Yes, indeed. So if you're desperate enough.
If you're desperate enough. I wouldn't want to dig a fork into what I ferment in that bucket. But if I didn't have food to eat and needed to eat something, it would support my body.
Right.
Because it's good microbes.
It's pickled.
Okay?
Yes.
Right.
Understood. Now, you said it could clear up the sludge in the septic system. You put some of this bran in the septic, the tank?
Well, it accelerates the composting process that happens in a septic system.
And that's anaerobic, of course.
And you have to pump the system less often because there's less solid matter left in there when it's all done. And people just put an eighth of a cup of that in their tank once a month, and that's all they need.
I see. Anything else we should know?
Well, to those people that have reservoirs and ponds, you can take the liquid form, the effective microbe solution, and mix that with some molasses and go around the edge of the pond and sprinkle it around, and it takes care of all the algae in ponds and stock tanks, etc.
How does it do that?
The microbes just go to work. They start digesting all the other microbes in the water, known as algae.
I see.
There's what you ask about what's in our future, and there are two things. One is we're in active conversations and developing a year-round greenhouse system in this community, and we're going to go into this complex of greenhouses and take our own soil in with us that's coming from the food bank's composting system, and we'll be growing greenhouses full of vegetables out of their very own rich soil. And the other thing is that next spring there will be a couple of organic farmers in this area who will be introducing a small volume of bokashi into their seed drills when they go to plant their lentils.
Uh-huh.
Because we want to see what happens, as we've heard from elsewhere in the country, that when you put bokashi into the soil, it really enhances the production of good, healthy grains, in this case, lentils.
Right. Well, I'll be interested to see what happens with that trial.
Well, yeah, we will, too.
Yes, indeed, I'm sure.
Uh-huh.
Thank you both. Is there anything crucial I have forgotten to ask?
No, Kate, I think you've covered it. And I know that this is, like I said, the learning curve can sometimes be steep with bokashi. But we're just know that we're available for helping people find their way and answers, okay?
So people can get
our website.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So people can send you questions and you're likely
Please
to answer?
Do.
Absolutely.
Do. Yeah.
All right. Good to
it's
know.
The tipping point, you know, we all have to be about it and stay out of the way and let it come.
All right. Well, I think you're lending your weight to it, in fact, in a good way.
So thank you.
Yes. Thank you both.
All right, Kate, thanks so much.
All right, take care and good luck with your enterprises.
Thanks so much.
All right.
Bye.
That was Michael Dalton and MJ Arends of Sunburst Unlimited. You can also find them on their website for bokashi, Gardens from Garbage. But before leaving them entirely, I decided I wanted to talk to somebody whom they had worked with in this large-scale bokashi program. And the person who fell into my clutches was Gail Gifford, the director of the food bank in Great Falls, Montana. We'll conclude with your gardening tip for the week, of course, but first, a conversation with Gail Gifford.
I am really pleased to be speaking with you. I really appreciate your time.
Not at all.
And, of course, I am speaking with you because you have been working with Michael Dalton and MJ, and I am not going to get her last name right.
Arendis.
Arends.
Uh-huh.
Yes. And you've been working with both of them in their bokashi program.
Right. In a couple of different ways.
Oh, really?
Yeah. We were one of the first sites that they had for the Bokashi process composting. And we wanted to do that to help eliminate some of our waste that's going out into the landfill.
Uh-huh.
And we also utilized the Bokashi process and allowed him to use that as kind of his training ground, since most of his experience with Bokashi was in an entirely different climate than Montana had.
I see.
So last year was our learning curve, and then we started this year working with him in the production of it, which got so huge that he had to move to another location, but we still serve as a retail site for him.
You say you started working with him in the production? How?
Right.
What role did you play there?
Well, he did a lot of the fermenting in his own area, probably in his backyard or something, and then we had some space up in our attic that was kind of a great location for temperature and ventilation and so on for the drying of the Bokashi.
I see.
Which is about a 48-hour process itself.
Is that all?
Yeah, it's not long. The longest tart part is the fermenting, which is about 21 days.
Right, right.
And then the actual drying is rather short.
Uh-huh, you know? I gather. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
I'm surprised. But nice.
Yeah, it was. And so he was able to turn over, you know, a batch on a weekend and come in here and spread it out on a Friday evening. And then by Sunday, he was ready to start bagging it and
uh-huh.
did a lot of that up there. But again, his sales started increasing so dramatically that he had to move
poor
to a
larger man,
facility.
Poor man.
Yeah,
Could we all have such problems?
Yeah, exactly. If every business had the problem where they're so big, within a couple months, they have to move, you know.
Really? Yeah.
But it was good news for, you know, both of us, of course. Because
so he's moved out of your attic.
Pardon me?
He has moved his operation out of the food bank attic?
Yeah, yeah. So now we just serve as a retail location. So if individuals want to purchase it, they can come here and get it or get it from him, either one.
I see. Mm-hmm. Huh. Now, what led to the burgeoning of his business?
You know, I've known Mike for a long time, and he had stopped in when they got back in town a few years ago. He was in Hawaii doing a lot of business there and came back to Montana after having been gone for a while and came here and asked if there was something, you know, that I could lend to him as far as, you know, connections, information. This is what he wanted to do and bring
uh-huh.
this back to Montana. And I said, wow, you couldn't have hit it a better time. One of our concerns that we'd had was, along with the increase of a lot of fresh produce we have, naturally there's going to be some waste out of that can't be consumed fast enough. And we were having our garbage costs were just out of the roof because I was having to pay for double and triple the amount of garbage that was being hauled out of here every month. And
oh,
it just really
kidding.
Bothered me. Yeah. Well, our first year that we didn't had the grocery rescue where we were getting a lot of produce that has maybe a 3 to 5 day window that we can get rid of it. Our waste was about 85,000 pounds in 1 year. And so that's a lot. In addition to that cost, I was really, you know, of course, being environmentally conscious, we were concerned about the amount that was going to the landfill, and it was
right.
just kind of disturbing. So we got talking about the compost process and thought the bins would be ideal here for us to do that, especially because the Bokashi process is cold. It is not, doesn't have to be turned. It's very low odor, those types of things that it would be ideal for a food bank location.
Mm-hmm.
And
why did the fact that it was cold seem like an advantage to you?
Again, it's the lack of effort that it takes to have it processed. In other words, it doesn't smell as bad when it's hot versus it's cold, and you don't have to turn it. It does its own composting. You don't
right.
have to have staff go out there, and I just didn't want to dedicate staff to that hours a day when we had other things that we needed to have them do. So, and it was the smell, the odor was what my main concern was, because I didn't want to attract any animals, and they're working around a food warehouse, so it would not work out to have a real smelly, messy process going on, you know, right next door to us.
Right, right.
So we decided to do the composting, and not only for the cost of it, but I really like the idea of being able to take our waste and turn it back around into full circle, because as the soil becomes usable for gardens, we're turning it back over to the community gardens and the backyard gardeners that are donating a lot of produce for us.
Oh, I was going to ask where the product goes.
Yeah, so the compost itself kind of takes its full circle. It comes from the waste that we get from the excess of the produce or that goes to waste, and then it turns back into fresh soil for the gardeners who give us that produce.
Right.
So it was just a positive thing all the way around. The gardeners benefit by some very valuable and expensive, if they were to purchase it on the market, compost.
Right. So you're not selling it? Are you giving it away?
We give it away, yeah. If they donate produce to us, we in turn in the spring ask them if they'd like to have some compost, and we give them a couple buckets of compost.
I see.
Yeah.
And how much do you have available in a year? Actually, last year was your first year doing this?
We did it for the first time last winter.
Okay.
We did learn a lot through the winter process. Again, we knew this when we went into it with Mike, that because he was dealing with a different climate than what he was accustomed to, we weren't sure how it was going to work.
Uh-huh.
And we did kind of have a bit of a stall in the production of the compost. We ended up with a couple of bins full, probably about 2,000 pounds worth of soil.
Okay, that's a fair amount.
Yeah, it is. It is. It's definitely worth it. But we're kind of wondering next year, now that we've got the system going and up and running in a much more productive manner, we could double that by next year.
How many bins do you have there?
We have 7 bins, and each bin holds about 3,000 pounds of waste.
Really?
Which then kind of compacts down to about 1,000 pounds of compost.
A 4x4? Box holds 3,000 pounds?
Yeah, yeah. When you're talking about produce, it's on the heavier side if we do lighter weight things and not quite so much. But that's kind of our guideline, is we don't like to go up above that.
That sounds like plenty.
Yeah, that does sound like plenty, yeah.
How long does it take you to fill one bin?
It depends on the time of the year and what types of product that we're putting it into it, because one of the things we've become aware of is you can't have too much greens, you can't have too much bread. There has to be a nice balance of different chemicals in there, and so that somewhat slows it down a little bit, but just makes us a little more conscious of the types of things that we can put in there.
So do you still have to throw some stuff away in a conventional manner?
Yes, because we do not throw away any meats, poultry, eggs. You can't throw, like, corn on the cob in there because it doesn't break down fast enough.
Right.
The whole Bokashi composting process is supposed to take 9 weeks. What we found is because of that would be in the average, backyard compost, because of the volume of hours, it takes a little bit longer. So one bin can take us a couple months to fill up.
Right. But when I asked whether you were throwing things away, I meant, green things and bread. If you have to watch the balance of what you put into the bins, are you throwing away some stuff then?
No, actually, we're able to do that, and that's one of the benefits of having the 7 bins, because let's just say we get a bumper crop of lettuce and we can't utilize the lettuce or it goes bad too fast for us to distribute it, then we can space that lettuce out over a couple of bins.
I see.
So that it's not all in one bin and just way too much lettuce and that's it.
Right.
So we usually have a couple of bins going at the same time, and just one finishes up faster than the other, and then we roll over to the next one.
I see. Okay, so you're filling a couple of bins while others are brewing.
Right. Uh-huh. We don't just focus on one bin at a time.
Right.
And then the things that we can't use in the compost bin do go out into the trash, and that's the things that just don't compost well, like the meats and dairy and that type of stuff. And just to give an example, the first year we did our compost bins back there, like I said, the year before we did 85,000 pounds of waste. Last year was down to 40,000 pounds of waste.
That's extraordinary.
Yeah.
And that was when you didn't fully have it up and running yet.
No, no. So we definitely have learned ways to make it more efficient. And again, I really like the idea of being able to take that donation that we've gotten and turn it full circle back around into more food.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, it sounds as though if you are putting 3,000 pounds of garbage in each of 7 bins and you get 1,000 pounds of compost out of each, and you might add more bins, you're going to have over 7,000 pounds of compost a year. Can you give away that much?
Probably can. I don't see, you know, once we get rolling on it, I think some of the other issues that we have is we want to do some testing. Of course, there's always in the distant future to be thinking about a retail market, but we're more concentrated on
making sure
that.
That was what I was wondering.
Yeah, you know, and that could very well be. It would be fun to get it that far, and it would definitely be a nice revenue source for the food bank is to be able to produce that compost for some revenue income.
Uh-huh.
But our main goal right now is just to make sure that those people that donate to us in some way, you know, benefit from this as well. It's kind of our little perk
That's
for them.
Nice. Keep them coming back.
Yep.
You said you wanted to do some testing. What kind of testing?
Well, one of the things that we've talked about with the health department and with DEQ is to make sure that the compost, number one, you know, is clean and there's no contaminants or anything like that in there. And then there's also certain qualities of compost that you can have, and this takes on a whole new science level that, you know, we're just kind of starting to get into. But you can have compost that's too high in certain chemicals or minerals that will either burn up or not do any benefit for a plant. And so we need to test the soil. We had a batch tested early on in it, way before we got started with all seven of the bins. And while it was within reasonable range, we had a couple of areas that we were higher on, nothing that would damage any plants, but it would not necessarily put it at the prime market value.
Do you know what those were?
You know, I don't have my studies here in front of me. I think one of them was phosphates, if I remember right.
We're high?
We're a little on the higher side.
Okay.
And that's one other thing that we're taking a look at with our biologists is what composition in the soil would we need to adjust in order to bring those down?
Mm-hmm.
And that's something else that they're taking a look at. So it's not just throwing, you know, garbage in a bin and boom, you get dirt. There's quite a science behind it.
Indeed, there is.
Yeah.
So what you would need to adjust in the compost bins to get the
right
chemical
and
result.
Yep, and that we're learning that process all along. There's a couple things that we threw in there last year because we assumed bread was going to be just fine. Well, bagels didn't process. For some reason, didn't break down.
How interesting.
But now we know that. And then, you know, he's learning that you need to add more carbon and a little less grass. And, you know, those kinds of balances are all something that we're working through so that he can take this mixture and be able to utilize it in other areas.
Now, you mentioned our biologist.
We are working. We started first with Montana State University, and they are
there.
Yeah, we've been using some of the science brains over there and throwing some ideas back at them and saying, how can we do this?
You know, she's
actually helping them out with a lot of bins now. So
I
don't know her name. And
that's fine. But you said there were issues with the DEQ. Now, that's the Department
of Environmental Quality. Yeah. And it's not so much the issues that we have there. They're very curious about it, obviously, because it is a much easier process, cleaner, less smelly, those types of things. The Bokashi cold composting is a much more attractive process. So they're very curious about it.
I've got to jump in here for a moment and just say that hot composting, if done correctly, I mean, even if it's cold, in fact, conventional composting should not smell.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
But,
and I think that's the backyard composter doesn't always know what that composition is.
Right. Well, as you said, with your process, you're learning.
Mm-hmm.
But
we've
at
learned.
Any rate, the DEQ was interested because it's got real advantages.
It's a different process and in some ways, you know, a little more attractive than the hot compost process. So we haven't necessarily had any issues. I mean, everything that we're doing is fully approved here, but they are very curious about it and asking a lot of questions and talking to both Mike and I about how it works and any of the pitfalls or advantages that we've had and those types of things. And I'm not sure if it's just a curiosity on their standpoint or if they're hoping to be able to, you know, get this as replicated in other areas.
I see. How did they even become involved?
Well, we wanted to make sure that when we did this, we were doing it right and that we weren't running into any health department issues where some of the placement of the compost bins were because they're in not only our facility, but they're at schools and other business locations. And so we wanted to make sure that we weren't running into any health concerns.
Right.
And we have not run into any of those. And then DEQ, we've contacted just to make sure that there wasn't any permit issues that we needed to handle. You know, those types of things.
Mm-hmm.
that so we just wanted to make sure that we were compliant with all the regulations, that
right.
we weren't in violation anywhere.
Right. And they've mm-hmm. stayed interested.
Yes, they did.
Oh,
yes,
nice.
They did.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and again, as we're learning more about it, we're, you know, teaching them and showing them what's going on with it, and prompts a few more questions, and then we go back and explore some more. But like I said, our bins are seasoned enough now. I think we should probably have a pretty good crop of compost next year out of all of the bins.
Well, I'm sure your local gardeners will be grateful.
Yes. Yeah, I hope so.
I might have to move to Great Falls.
Yeah. Well, and the bokashi itself is a pretty amazing product. The more I'm not as efficient at it and proficient at it as they are, as the Daltons are, but we're uncovering more and more all the time as to what we can use with it as far as even fertilizers and septic tanks and things like that. It's
right.
Kind of
they mentioned some of that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing. Well, thank you so much, Gail. I really appreciate the time.
You're welcome.
And it's wonderful to hear from one of the clients, if you will, about how the program has been working.
Yeah, it's been a huge benefit for us, and we're really pleased to be able to provide ourselves as a model to other organizations that might want to do this as well.
Yeah, it sounds like it's spreading.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It is, definitely.
Good.
Yeah.
Thanks again.
You're welcome. Thank you.
That was Gail Gifford, Executive Director of the Food Bank in Great Falls, Montana. And now for this week's gardening tip, which I am stealing from Linda Chalker-Scott, my guest a couple of weeks ago on the show Fall Gardening Tasks. And in one word, the tip is mulch. Many flower gardeners do mulch, especially their shrubs or young trees, but a lot of vegetable gardeners just pull all of the plants and leave the soil bare. This actually can cause a number of problems. It can cause erosion and also the leaching of nutrients from the soil, especially with heavy fall rains or when the snow melts in the spring. And finally, as Linda pointed out, it can also cause the top several inches of the soil to freeze in colder areas. And this, at the very least, will slow down the rejuvenation of soil microbes and so on in the spring. So, in a word, once again, mulch. You can use Linda's ever-present wood chips. You can use straw. Don't use hay. You'll be forever fighting the resulting weeds. But one of the simplest things you can use, and one that's pretty much available anywhere to any gardener, is leaves. If you don't like the look of them in spring, you can peel them back off again. But they're, generally speaking, free. They do a good job, and they're easy to apply. So protect your soil, protect your plants, and get that layer on top of the soil before winter sets in. Goodbye for now, and good gardening.
Inch by inch, row by row, gonna make this garden grow. All it takes is a rake and a hoe and a piece of fertile ground. And inch by inch, row by row, someone blessed these seeds I sowed. Someone warmed them from below till the rains come.